Hello and welcome back to another episode of Observations for Our Time. I am Yada. We're here with Scott and Kirk. How are you guys?
Good. Terrific. Thank you.
I'm really good. Okay. Yeah. It's my favorite day of the week. So.
Well, we have two programs today. We'll follow up this one with our Shabbat program, 7:30 Eastern Time, 4:30 Pacific Time on Yada Yada Radio. But now we're going to return to Proverbs 6. We had covered, I think, up to about 11 or 12, the statements 11 and 12 in our last program. But let's kind of retrace our ground steps with the most logical starting point here, which would be Proverbs 6:9. And to put this all in perspective, we have considered two long chapters of material where Yahweh and Shamuel 1, 1 Samuel 7, I think the third verse, lays out his case against religion. And we then trace down the foes that were listed in that statement, the Philisti and the Astarte, the Queen of Heavens and Mother of God, and looked at what God had to say about these two villains elsewhere in his testimony, and came to understand his animosity towards religion and politics. And then in 1 Samuel 8, we covered God's thesis against government and why he says we ought not align ourselves with human governance because it is wholly counterproductive and consistently working against our interests. But we got into all of this based upon a proverb that we had reviewed briefly prior to doing a more comprehensive review of it, which is a proverb from a father to a son. The father in this case happens to be Yahweh, our heavenly father. The son is anyone who is part of the covenant or is interested in becoming part of the covenant. And it begins by the father telling the son that if you've ever made a pledge, given an oath to any adversarial institution, which would be any government or religious or military institution, then you need to cease and desist, separate yourself from them, confront them, and explain to them why you are no longer allied with them. And then God goes on to explain his overt animosity towards these things. And then he then tells us that our apathy, ignorance, if you will, is bliss. That the excuse, I just didn't know, if you had only told me, it's not fair, you know, I was misled, that that's going to fly as well as a lead balloon. This is the question that is a rhetoric question that God asks. For how long and to what extent? Inactive, apathetic, and lethargic one, will you just lie there and remain inactive? When and what will it take for you to arise and stand up from your altered state of awareness, from your slumber, from being unaware and unresponsive? That's really not a question that I would want God asking of me.
No, not at all. I know this is a little early in the in our discussion to throw something in, but I found some really neat stuff. Did you know the word you just said about being relaxed, rest, and sleep, shakab? Mm-hmm. When you go back to the root, you know what it also means? It means to rest or sleep or lay down for copulation. And when you add that in with sleeping with Babel, the comments he's been making prior to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Whore of Babylon. Yeah,
the Whore of Babylon.
Sleeping with the Whore. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So it's
that is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember seeing the inferences in the word that suggest that it could be and was sometimes used to speak of sleeping with someone for the purpose of conceiving a child, or at least sleeping with them for the purpose of having sex, if you will.
Well, they need to look at it symbolically,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
right. And, yeah, and I did not, it did not resonate with me because I at the time wasn't, when I translated, wasn't thinking of how adroitly we were going to be confronted with a whore. And yet it's this proverb that is introduces us specifically to the whore. It's why most English commentaries on this passage say that this is a proverb on adultery. And yet it has nothing to do with sex.
No.
So I just immediately discounted the sleeping with the for the purpose of sex, whether it be in prostitution or marriage, from this, just because of the fact that I really wanted to distance what we were studying from this notion that this proverb was about adultery.
Yeah.
And but you are correct, because the proverb, well, this is not about adultery in the terms, in the sense of having an illicit affair as a married individual. This is about adultery in the spiritual sense, and breaching the covenant, which is a marriage vow, and having relations with the adversary. And this adversary here is depicted as the whore of Babylon. So the one who prostitutes herself in the guise of religion. So it is, I mean, that is a valid insight into the word. No question about it.
These whole passages are so filled with this, having gone back the second time, you know, because we did do a lot of this one time on the show, on the previous show, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, honest to goodness, I couldn't believe so many of these things are in there as well, that as long as you had the context, like I was telling Scott, as long as you had the context of who we're talking about and what we're talking about, then they just blow you away. I wish I really spoke ancient Hebrew.
One of the reasons that I would not want God to ask me this question, you know, how long are you going to stay ignorant and, you know, unaware, unresponsive? And that's really the thing. How long are you going to stay unaware and unresponsive? Is because God has gone to great lengths to provide us information that would make anyone who is observant aware. And he is so clear about what he is offering, and what he is offering is so beneficial for us, costing us so little and gaining us so much, that it is to be unresponsive is just stunningly wasteful of one's soul.
Mm-hmm.
And so for God to be asking this question, the person has to willfully and knowingly choose
to do nothing,
to ignore his Torah guidance.
Yeah, because what did you ever ask us that was so hard other than Shemar Torah and then make a decision?
Right. Read my instructions. Read my guidance. Study it. Come to understand what I'm offering. Come to know who I am by Shemar, observing my Torah instructions. And then, if you like who I am, if you think you'd enjoy spending time with me, if you view the offer as beneficial, well, then by all means, respond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, engage in a relationship. That's really all he's asking of us, is to step away from those who are misleading us, those in religion and politics and other human institutions, to step away from them long enough to recognize that they're not providing a viable answer, that they're actually doing nothing but offering false hope, and that there really is an offer out there. There really is a God worth knowing, and that it is in all of our interest to take some time out of our lives to get to know him, to decide whether or not we like him, because he bears no resemblance to the religious God. If you like the religious God, you're going to hate the real God.
Mm-hmm.
If you hate the religious God, chances are you'll like the real one. But if you don't know him, then, you know, why in the world are you asking him to save you? Why are you asking him to spend eternity with you if you don't even know him? And if you're clueless as to what he's asking, what he's offering, why are you praying to him?
Valid point.
Yeah. So he's this is a rhetorical question. He says, for how long and to what extent, inactive, apathetic, and lethargic one, will you just lie there and remain inactive? You know, will you ever arise and stand up? What will it take for you to arise and stand up from your being unaware and unresponsive? And that is another one of those things that is constantly before us. I just started writing the fourth chapter of Observations for Our Time, and I'm taking the approach here of, because I'm covering the 91st Psalm, which was my first real set of instructions and guidance from God, a God that I didn't even know at the time. So I decided I'm going to lay out the set of circumstances that came to exist for this psalm to be so meaningful. It's the psalm that launched 3 million words in all of the books, 5,000 radio shows, 3 million words, are all directly initiated by this psalm. So I, you know, told the story. This is what God asked, how he asked it, what I said in return, and how that all led to the psalm. And I am constantly reminded by people who said, you know, well, there's no way that I'm going to trust a God that I can't see. That unless God were to speak to me, then I don't really care to know him. Well, you know,
he does.
I think the reason that that this God chose to speak to me certainly wasn't because I was qualified. I didn't win any prize. It wasn't because I had something special to offer. It's that I think it's only two things. One is he knew that I was just about the only person out there who was willing to do what he wanted done. And second, he knew, because he exists outside of our 3.5 dimensions, stuck in time as we are, he could see into the future in our 3.5 dimensions and recognize that ultimately I was going to respond. I was going to take the time to get to know him. I would go where the words lead, even if they destroy everything that I held true. And that's really where you've got to be.
Well, you've got to be willing. To be the case, yeah, indeed.
Yeah, yeah. Are you willing to go where the words lead? Are you willing to invest the time to be observant? Do you want to get to know him? Are you going to have fun with him? Are you going to enjoy his company or not? And so God is pleading with those he has created for us to wake up.
Yeah.
And to get to know what he is like and what he is offering. And this question of what will it take for you to do so? Well, for me, it was that one request. Will you do this? Will you do this for me? And that we engaged in a dialogue. But the vast majority of people, he's not going to do that for. And the reason he's not going to do that for, their mindset is that they're not going to be bothered.
No.
And if bothered enough to listen and to engage in a discussion, they are not going to go with the words lead if those words call them to be
your lifestyle.
Right, to reject patriotism and nationalism and politics and religion and all of those kinds of things. They aren't going to go there. Too uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to see God, all you have to do is observe his Torah. Right there. He is more visible in his Torah, more clearly recognizable in his Torah, than he was when he led the children of Israel out of Egypt, or when he walked in the dusty lanes of Jerusalem in year 4000 33 CE. more recognizable, more obvious, more clearly visible, easier to know, right there in the words of the Torah.
Yeah.
The Torah represents him. Yeah, I was just going to say the Torah represents him far better than did the fire on the top of the mountain,
mm-hmm.
or did the flesh that was on the skeleton of the individual body that represented the sacrificial lamb. These words are as close to a perfect representation of him as there is. And in these words, you found his mindset. He's frustrated with people, saying, you know, what will it take for you to shed your ignorance, for you to care enough to no longer be unaware?
Well, this has been the first time that I had done a lot of personal translating, many months ago, or several months ago, and then had revisited it and redid it because I couldn't find my notes, so I just redid it. And later I did find my notes, and I found, my gosh, there is so much left on the bone, so much meat on the bone I never even got to.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing, you know, because a lot of times you'll say, not only, obviously it's great fun to do this, but it's also, you always say, you know, when I went back and retranslated something the second time without assuming this is what it means completely.
Right.
And then you dig it up and you dig and you dig and you dig and you look at all and have a few more sources perhaps than I did before too. But you go through and you go, my gosh, I missed that completely. You know, and it's just so thrilling.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's been a case of every time that I've edited any of these books, and I think Yada Yada, for example, has been edited either 7 or 8 times.
Mm-hmm.
And if I were to edit it now, and the reason I edited it is I'd learned something that caused me to have to go back and make a lot of corrections. Like when I first wrote it, I thought there was something called a renewed covenant. I knew there was no New Testament, but I thought there was a renewed covenant. And come to find out, there is no such thing as a renewed covenant. The covenant will be renewed, but it has not been renewed now. So the past tense renewed covenant, that doesn't exist. And therefore, the text of what's called the New Testament cannot be valid. So I had to go back and I had to rewrite a bunch of things based upon learning that.
I recall I had to reprint them.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, but that was just the case. But I will tell you
That's all right.
That if I were to go back and retranslate every passage and that which is like 3,500 pages worth of material, 7 volumes of Yada Yada, there isn't a single passage that would remain the same. Because you're constantly learning, you're constantly seeing new insights. This is a voyage of discovery. And so, you go through it, and the more time you spend, the more you learn. And the more times you go back, the more you see. It's all about how closely are you willing to examine the words? How carefully are you willing to consider them? But if you're not, if you're satisfied with never reading, and, you know, I would tell you that my youngest son spent 2 years at a Christian college, and they required him to take classes on the New and Old Testament from their perspective. And the New Testament, of course, he did miserably in those because he knew that it was a farce and was really challenging to his professor, who was a significant player in the New Living Translation, which is absolute rubbish. And as he went into his quote unquote Old Testament class, that professor was even worse. And he was a Calvinist, you know, predestination, no free will, that sort of thing.
I understand.
And one of the things that occurred is the professor says, okay, how many of you have read the first 5 books of the Bible? Only one hand went up. My sons.
Really?
Yeah. Here's a Christian college. None of them had read them. So if you're not willing to read them, you aren't going to get anywhere. And I'm going to tell you that if you're satisfied with merely reading them in a religious publication, New American Standard, the New Living Translation, the King James or New King James, the NIV, if you're satisfied with just reading them in one of those religious publications, you're going to be better off than the person who has not read it, but you're maybe going to know 1/1,000,000th of 1% of what God said.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to be cluttered with a great many things he did not say.
Yeah.
Pretty low correlation.
All that you can't. Yeah.
Yeah. Really a low correlation between the words that Yahweh conveyed and the language that he conveyed them and the translations promoted by these religious institutions. Really an extraordinarily low correlation. So this is why he's saying what follows. A little inactivity leads to laziness, to folding one's hands together in a lethargic manner to rest. And here this rest, shakab, is the same word that means that it leads to having an affair with the whore.
Mm-hmm.
This whore of Babylon, the confusion and corruption of religion. So, the fact is that if you're lazy and you're not willing to dig in, if you're not willing to scratch beneath the surface, if you're not willing to think about this, if you're not willing to make connections, if it's such a low priority to you that you're not going to invest the time, then you're never going to know God.
You could just ask the question, if you've got a folded up hand, the yacht, mm-hmm. what can you accomplish? You're not going to, that's nothing. So that's, you can't even open a tent door.
Right. Yeah, if your hands are folded,
you're not doing anything.
Unfurling, if you were the scroll.
Anything.
Yeah, the scroll of the Torah. You're not, even today, you know, we're not working with scrolls. We work online. Typically, we work on our computers. And I have a Word document, and then I have a fairly powerful search engine related to the Core Prophets and Psalms. I use a lot of those software. And, you know, the difference between it and all the hardback books I have is that it'll bring up any number of interlayers. I usually have two open all the time. And then each word in the interlinear is then presented with up to 12 different lexicons. And each word has the stem, the mood, the conjugation, the voice of the verb is all presented. And it's clear about first, second, third person, masculine, feminine, singular, plural, all of those kinds of grammatical things that help a person understand.
Yeah.
It's all laid out there. And as well as when you go to any one of these lexicons, you can look at all of the words that are written similarly prior to the Masoretic vocalization. And then you can look at, if it's a noun, you can look at the actionable root of the word, which is typically the verbal root, and come to have an appreciation of the core meaning of that word. And you can also look at the way the letters are drawn to appreciate what's being conveyed.
Sure.
But that takes a lot of time.
Yes.
You don't do it quickly. And you really got to want to do this. You've got to really enjoy doing this. It's got to be more interesting to you than watching television.
Yeah.
For example, or playing a video game, for example. It's got to be a priority to you, or chances are you're going to be like this person here, you know, that a little inactivity breeds laziness to folding one's hands together in a lethargic manner. It is something that we witness a lot in society, where generations of people, particularly in inner cities, have been conditioned not to work. Their parents didn't work. They don't work. Their children won't work. And one of the things that I noticed in business was that if you want something done, you give it to the busiest person. Hey, that sounds counterintuitive. You'd say if you want something done, give it to the person that's idle. No, the problem is with a person that's prone to idleness never gets started. They never get going. They got all the time in the world, they just don't use it. And the person that's busy, that's active,
they just fit it in there somewhere.
Fit it in there. They know how to get it done. They engage. They make it happen. I remember when I was at some of the most challenging times of my business life, and I would begin each day with a long list of things that needed to be done, and I would add to it the things that I didn't get done the previous day. And what I tried to do was whatever the thing was that I wanted to do the least, that's where I started.
Mm-hmm.
Get that sucker done and out of the way, so I never look at it anymore.
Yeah, good idea.
And just kept on plugging through it and crossing things off. And there was a satisfaction when you cross something off the list, and you reduced its length. But that really is the reason, I think, more than anything else, that we're in this place that we have come to, is that we enjoy doing the work. We enjoy engaging in the process of shedding our ignorance, of coming to become more aware of who God is and what He's offering.
Yes.
That's why we do this
really
program.
Really understand something.
I agree. So then this next line is really close to where we were previously, and it says, "For He will come, walking and behaving like a leader or guide, taking control, and you will lack what's needed, and have a scarcity of something absolutely vital, needing what you do not have, causing you to be bereaved and to be diminished." Now, for the remaining part of this proverb, which goes on now, this is the 11th verse, I think it goes on to 35 or 36.
Right.
God's going to be addressing a singular individual.
Uh-huh.
This is it. "For He will come." Masculine, singular. "For He." It's not saying "for they will come."
No, a person.
No, yeah. "For He will come." Singular.
Mm-hmm.
Masculine. "Walking and behaving like a leader or guide, taking control." The verb, written. In the third person, masculine. Singular.
Right.
"And you will lack what is needed." Now, the reason that that's important is that it behooves us, if we want to understand, to process who might be, to consider who might it be that God is talking about. This was written, and chances are by Dode. We don't really have authorship of the Proverbs. The reason we don't have authorship of the Proverbs is because there isn't any merit in us knowing who jotted them down.
Mm-hmm.
So long as Yahweh's name is used in a manner, and the testimony is consistent with his overall witness, and there is something in it that is prophetic that we can use to demonstrate that God authored it, then it doesn't matter whose human hands held the writing implement. But we do know that these things were written right around the time of Dode, David, which was approximately 1000 BCE. So we're looking for an individual that will meet all of these criterion after 1000 BCE. Now, what we're also looking for is, he's just talked about apathy. And so we now know that this individual, you can thwart their designs. You can minimize their threat to the potential to mislead you by not being apathetic, by shedding your ignorance. The more you know, the less prone to being misled you're going to be.
Cannot be vulnerable at all, no.
Right. So, and as we move forward through this, and he gets very explicit about this individual, what we will learn is that the antidote, the specific antidote, the thing that you need to know to avoid being misled, is the Torah and its mizmor. It's our mitzvah. It's terms and conditions associated with the relationship. That if you know those things, if you are keenly aware of them, that this individual cannot mislead you. So God's going to say that this individual is going to distort the Torah in such a way that if you are not aware of the Torah, if you're unaware of the Torah and ignorant of it,
how would you know?
Then you're going to be taken advantage of.
Sure.
So that is an enormously important clue. So this person is going to come walking and behaving like a leader or guide, taking control, and you will lack what is needed and have a scarcity of something absolutely vital.